Welcome to today's edition of the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. In addition to feature reports, I'll bring you a look at regional and national agricultural news. And the show starts right after this.
Smart growers know sustainability means managing pests at the same time they manage other priorities in their fields, which is why smart growers know Certis Biologicals. For more than 20 years, Certis Biologicals has been the world's leader when it comes to biological pesticides, delivering proven solutions that keep operations sustainable and growing. Learn more at CertisBio.com.
We're waking up to a new dawn in agriculture, a better way, where farmers stop working the soil and start working with it. At Huma, our carbon-rich, humate-based products improve soil health and fertility, deliver nutrients more efficiently, and reduce crop input costs. Welcome to Humic Solutions with a human touch. Visit huma.us to learn more.
The 2023 Walnut Objective Measurement Survey utilized a total of 675 blocks with two sample trees per block. Survey data indicated an average nut set per tree of 1,004, up 2% from 2022's average of 981. Percent of sound kernels in shell was 99.2% statewide. The average in-shell weight and dimensions for 2023 were 21.5 grams. Suture measurement was 32.7 millimeters. Cross-width measurement was 33.3, and the average length was 39.1. millimeters. The cold winter temperatures ensured chill hours were sufficient for walnut trees. A wet winter and spring helped to restore soil moisture in walnut orchards across the state. Percent sound results from the objective measurement survey indicate nut quality will be increased from last year. Growers across the state struggled with high production costs. Estimated nut sets, sizing measurements, average number of trees per acre, and estimated bearing acreage were used in the statistical models. A weed sample collected in Butte County on September 19th was submitted to the California Department of Food and Agriculture Botany Lab for identification. The sample was identified as whitewater fire. Notes from the CDFA lab indicated this is the first record of the plant in California and possibly in the USA. CDFA has assigned a temporary Q rating pending California's pest rating proposal and public comment period to establish a permanent rating. The sample was collected from a rice field and was found growing inside the field. It was not growing on banks or ditches. It appears the preferable habitat is rice fields and marshy areas. It looks similar to red stem, but the stem itself is much larger in diameter and less dense. Currently, there is little information globally on the plant, how invasive it is, and how it impacts rice fields. The plant is native to Africa and China and has been identified in parts of Central America. Since the initial identification, the Butte County Department of Agriculture has surveyed additional rice fields and did not find it in any other location. One of the common ways of spread is the cultivation of rice. As with all noxious weed species in commercial agricultural settings, it's important to follow best management practices. This may include roguing field of species prior to harvest and cleaning and sanitizing equipment post-harvest. As more information is gained from partners at CDFA, the County Agricultural Commissioner's Office will disseminate information to all interested parties. The California Avocado Commission has announced that Jeff Oberman, who served as president and CEO of the organization since October of 2022, has left the organization to pursue other interests. Oberman was brought in as the first external hire to be president and CEO of the commission in over three decades, bringing many years of experience to the role. Over the past year, CAC implemented significant changes that have strengthened the organization and its standing in the industry. Robert Grether, chairman of the commission, expressed gratitude for Oberman's service and his positive contributions to the organization. About one-third of all food produced in the United States gets tossed each year. Worldwide, the United Nations has estimated that half of all fruits and vegetables go to waste. Now, a new study claims that automated, non-invasive, and scalable technologies can play a role in reducing all that waste. Researchers from Princeton University and Microsoft Research have developed a fast and accurate way to determine fruit quality through the use of high-frequency wireless technology. The new tool can give suppliers a way to sort fruit based on fine-grained ripeness measurements. It promises to help cut food waste by optimizing distribution. Good fruit picked from bad bunches and ripe fruit is then moved to the front of the line. This season's California citrus crop has been hit with a relatively poor fruit set, as well as significant thrip damage, which causes scarring on a fruit but does not impact the interior. The expected result is as much as 35% less fruit, but more opportunities for promotional pricing on bagged options. It's a case for both organic and conventional production. They're having frank and transparent conversations with retailers, according to Craig Morris, citrus category manager for Homegrown Organic Farms in Porterville. He says that they have explained the issue with thrips and are telling the retailers that they are hitting it with every available tool with marginal success. He says they are hoping that retailers can relax their receiving standards a bit so that they can make more of a crop. Moore said that while the scarring does not impact eating quality, it does present challenges on retail presentation as scarred fruit does not display well in bulk. Bagged fruit can mask the problem a bit, and once a consumer takes it home and cuts it open, there's no problem at all. Across the organic citrus category, when comparing yields this year with last year on a grove-to-grove basis, the organic category is down about 30%, with lemons and navels hurt the most. Morris, however, reiterated that even with a drop in volume, there should be good promotional opportunities, especially on navels, caracaras, and mandarins. Homegrown is expecting to harvest organic navels by the last week of October, with promotable volume by about November 10th. Morris expects volume on mandarins to be sufficient for promotion in the December to March timeframe. He believes Homegrown Organic Farms has the most robust organic citrus lineup in California, noting that besides the top four categories, which are navels, lemons, mandarins, and grapefruit, the company offers several specialty organic citrus options, including blood oranges, pomelos, and caracaras. While lemons were hit hardest by thrips, Morris noted that there was an oversupply of organic lemons last year, so this year's decreased volume should still allow for an in-sync supply and demand situation and lead to solid pricing. California avocado season crawled to a start in 2023 with harvest delayed into the summer due to both a wet spring and stubbornly low prices compared to spring of 2022, when a crop was fetching more than $2 a pound in March. Peak 2023 harvest came in June and July, 6 weeks later than expected, when Mexico was between its multiple avocado crops and California avocados finally found breathing room in the market as prices inched towards the $1.50 per pound level. In Carpinteria, where the mild climate affords longer avocado hang time on trees, many growers harvested in August and were able to enjoy a short window when prices for premium avocados again hit $2 a pound. Local ranch manager Rick Shade, whose company Shade Farm Management oversees avocado acreage between Moore Park and Goleta, gave the California avocado season a B grade for moderate volumes and pricing. Yet Carpinteria stood out for having an exceptionally good year. The crop locally was big, and growers who were able to seize favorable pricing finished the season with fatter returns. The issue is trying to figure out when Mexico will run out of fruit, according to Shade. In warmer places like Moore Park, there's concern if you wait too long, temperatures will cook and you'll lose the fruit. As of October 1st, nearly all California avocados have been harvested for the first year, representing nearly all commercially grown avocados in the U.S. The state's yield in 2023 was about 231 million pounds, 90% of which was the Haas variety mixed with the smattering of Lamb Haas, GEM, and other lesser grown avocado varieties. California had a bigger harvest in 2022 at 272 million pounds. Early expectations for 2024 are in a range of 200 million pounds for the Golden State. California's avocado growing region, ranging from San Diego to Morro Bay, has crept northward with the highest volumes of fruit coming from Ventura County, including the miles of avocado groves just up Casitas Pass Road from Carpinteria Valley. Carpinteria Valley, though it has just a couple thousand acres of avocados, is a prodigious producer. The California avocado industry averages 6,000 to 7,000 pounds per acre, but locally, some growers are pushing 30,000 pounds per acre. High fruit volume comes down to the climate, water, and soil. Hotter, drier places like San Diego have a built-in production disadvantage. Over the past decade, more and more California avocado production is migrating northward into Ventura and Santa Barbara counties, whereas historically, the industry found its footing in the inland foothills of San Diego County near Fallbrook, which hosts the annual Fallbrook Avocado Festival. Several speakers pleaded with the State Water Resources Control Board recently to rethink proposed regulations intended to reduce California's water use in the face of climate change. Making conservation a California way of life is a series of proposed regulations that stems from two laws passed in 2018. Those laws required the State Water Board to implement efficiency standards and performance levels for local agencies' water use. They would affect over 400 agencies across the state, public and private, that deliver water to 95% of state residents. The plan has four main goals: use water more wisely, end water waste, improve local drought defenses, and improve efficiency in drought planning for agricultural water use. Annual reporting requirements are currently part of the proposal. Sarah Rose, president of the Monte Vista Water District, said her staff is committed to conservation. However, she has concerns over the amount of reporting needed under the proposed regulations. She said it would add to her district's expenses. And Edward Jackson, president of Liberty Utilities California and a current president of the California Water Association, said the reporting requirements won't help customers who will feel the brunt in increased costs with disadvantaged communities hurt the most. The proposed regulations tentatively set for a summer 2024 adoption and October 2024 implementation would impact what the State Water Board calls urban retail water suppliers, not homes or businesses. The reduction goals would be individualized for each agency. Collectively, they're expected to drop urban water use by over 400,000 acre feet and help the state deal with changing water supply issues due to climate change. An acre foot is a common measurement used by water agencies. 1 acre foot is the amount of water on an acre if it were filled with a foot of water, or about 325,900 gallons. Water agencies could face fines or violations. However, current proposals call for no fines before November 1st of 2027. Some agencies already are hitting their goals. One of the proposed fines is targeted at agricultural water suppliers that fail to submit their agricultural water management plan. The State Department of Water Resources would work with a qualified person or group to prepare the plan for the water supplier. The supplier would pay for it. If the supplier failed to provide the needed data, it would face a $1,000 a day fine capped at $25,000 until it provides the data. Also of those who commented was Shelley Thompson, Director of Public and Legislative Affairs with the South Tahoe Public Utility District, who recommended a streamlined method for the required annual reporting. Her district has much of that information in other reports. She asked for a method to pull that existing data out instead of creating a new report.
This year's almond harvest is plodding along as growers grapple with variable nut maturity, high humidity, and rain while nuts were drying on the ground. Adding to the challenges are navel orangeworms, which continue to cause abnormally high reject levels. Mel Machado, Vice President of Member Relations for Blue Diamond Growers, says harvest is about 15 days behind normal. Nonpareils, the most widely grown variety, are following that schedule. Pollinizers, which mostly are harvested after nonpareils, aren't quite as far behind.
And growers have been telling me quite some time that they're 2 weeks behind, and it varies with the variety, but I'll say pound for pound, we're a good 15, 16 days behind last year as far as product coming in out of the fields. The nonpareil is definitely running the slowest. It appears that the pollinators are not as far off. I'm seeing Fritz and Monterey on the ground now, but hey, it is October.
Once growers have shaken the nuts to the ground, Machado says higher than normal humidity levels is slowing down drying. Normally, nuts lay on the ground for 7 to 10 days before being picked up. The Almond Board of California recommends against stockpiling if either the hull moisture content exceeds 12% or the kernel moisture exceeds 6%. High hull moisture also can cause problems with hull piles spontaneously combusting.
The humidity is the general problem. You've got a diverse maturity or a diffuse maturity in the trees with nuts on the ends of the branches that are dry or too dry, and nuts in the middle of the tree that are green and in some cases barely split. So you make the decision to shake those nuts to the ground, and now they're going to have to dry on the ground for an extended period of time to get them down low enough to where you can stockpile them and eventually run them through a hull or sheller. Well, with the humidities being what they are, the product's not drying. And I actually had one grower who says, I think this stuff's going backwards on me. It's actually gaining moisture instead of drying down. I'm very concerned about stockpiles with excessive moisture and getting condensation under the plastic causing some problems. And the hullermen are nervous about once they get the product hulled and shelled, they really can't have high moisture hulls out there in their facilities because they will combust.
Wet hulls also can cause problems at the huller. Machado says they don't separate as easily from the shells, requiring hullers to slow down. With this year's harvest and hulling already late, he says that's the last thing hullers want to do.
If the hull is pliable when it goes in to be hulled or shelled, it does not snap, then that slows down the hulling process. They can't feed the material in as fast as they normally would because it's harder to get off The hull will roll around, it'll curl up. It also is harder to separate out of the flow. And ultimately what it does is it reduces the speed of hulling, which is already tough enough right now. And then ultimately, as I said earlier, you've got the high risk hulls in piles that it could spontaneously combust and catch fire.
In addition, growers are being challenged with high reject levels caused by naval orangeworm. Machado has one word to describe it, horrible. While some areas of the state are better than others, he says even the best cases are still twice what they were last year.
In a simple word, horrible. I will say that the northern San Joaquin Valley, San Joaquin, Stanislaus, and Merced counties are better. You could humorously say, and yet it's a sick joke, they're only twice as bad as last year on average, where the Sacramento Valley and from Madera down to Kern is 3 and 4 times worse than last year. It's not unusual to see loads come in at 5% or more rejects. And growers that have never really had issues are running 5, 6, 7, 8% rejects, and it's primarily attributable to naval orangeworm.
Naval orangeworm damage also has replaced plant bugs, and brown spot is a topic of conversations among growers this year. The past few years, he says plant bug feeding, which causes brown indentations on the almond kernels, have been at the forefront as far as rejects.
It's still out there, but the naval orangeworm is so prevalent and so dominant, it's literally knocked brown spot and plant bug out of all the conversations. I've yet to have a conversation this year with a grower who's talking about brown spot. They're talking about naval orangeworm.
One of the indicators Machado looks at is turnout, which is the amount of meat pounds compared to the total harvest brought in from the orchard. This year, he says numbers are all over the board and are typically lower than last year. How that will affect the crop estimate of 2.6 billion meat pounds remains to be seen.
The turnouts themselves are something that I really watch. It is the percentage of the meat weight versus what came out of the field. Now, some people will say, why do you watch that? Because that's got dirt, wood, and rock in it. But it is a number that gives you an indication of which way the crop can go, a little better than you expected or a little lower than you expected. A 1% change in turnout on a 2.6 billion pound crop, which is the forecast this year, is 118 million pounds. So if I'm down a point, the crop is automatically 118 million pounds less. What I'm hearing from huller shellers is turnouts are definitely running down rather than up versus last year. And then you have to also consider, well, some of this high reject material, in a lot of cases, the nut's been totally consumed. It comes out of the shear rolls in the hauling shelling facilities and falls apart and gets aspirated out. So there's another way to lose more weight, and we're going to see a difference in turnout percentages. I'm seeing documented turnout percentages in the high teens, 17-18%. For nonpareil, I normally start my numbers at 22, and I normally go up a couple points from 22, but I always like to start conservative. Am I saying the crop is way off? It's still too early to tell. I will say in the northern San Joaquin, I've got hullermen and growers saying they're off 20% or so, and I am seeing that. It's different in other parts of the state. You got to keep in mind, though, the Sacramento Valley was so badly impacted by the freeze in the 22 crop that they're up considerably over 22, but still down below normal because of the cold, wet conditions we had in this year's blow. Short way of saying it, there's numbers all over the place this year.
Machado says he can't put his finger on just one cause of the high naval orangeworm problems. Instead, he said it started when growers couldn't get in to perform winter mummy removal, which is a cornerstone of NOW management. A strung-out bloom stretched out hull split and created spray timing questions. So-called abandoned orchards waiting to be removed and chipped provided a huge reservoir of naval orangeworm moths, which are strong flyers. He says even growers who did all the right things this season had high reject levels. Moving forward, Machado says those abandoned orchards need to be removed, and growers need to perform winter sanitation to avoid the amphibious assault of naval orangeworm seen this year.
It's a long answer, unfortunately. Well, what got us here? Poor sanitation last year because of the heavy winter rain. An extended bloom that gave us an extended hull split period, so timing was very difficult. Some poor grower decisions, you know, guys that said, I can't afford to do this or that. Some guys that cut corners. I absolutely do not believe in every other row spraying, and I can prove it doesn't work. And then ultimately, the just overwhelming amount of abandoned orchards. I call them abandoned. These are orchards waiting for it to be removed, but the removal companies are out there backlogged, you know, 12 months, 16 months is what I'm hearing. So, you know, how do we get out of this situation? First of all, we've got to drop the inoculum down. The number of moths out there, the number of larvae out there has to be reduced. It starts with sanitation. That is the foundation. And we're looking at an El Nino year that supposedly could bring us a lot of heavy winter rains. Short of that, what else can I do to drop the amount of inoculum, the amount of worms floating around out there? Joel Siegel advocates the idea of a mummy spray. I know that's controversial. There's some thought thoughts behind a mummy spray there in the end of April, May timeframe, what growers traditionally call the May spray, that make a lot of sense, and they should talk to their pest control advisors about that. Disruption, I'm a big believer in mating disruption. I see it work. This year, though, we had growers that disrupted and sprayed three times and still had 15% rejects. And I'm going to say it's largely because of the number of abandoned orchards that were pumping out the moths, and your neighbor or neighbors that may have cut some corners, and in essence, they were not helping as well. I really believe what we did this year was overpowered any control means we had with just an amphibious assault, if you will, of naval orange worm out there, and we weren't able to knock them down in sufficient numbers to get good control and good quality. So we've got to take these abandoned orchards out, and I've got a few ideas on how to do that and not have these abandoned orchards standing out there throughout the summer and into harvest pumping the moths out. Short way of saying it, I always ask growers, have you got a crappy neighbor? This year, everybody did, because these moths will fly for miles, and there's enough sources of them out there in the countryside that it was literally like an amphibious assault of naval orange worm.
Weather forecasters are predicting a strong chance for an El Nino winter marked by higher than normal rains. With that in mind, it would be a good idea for growers to not put off winter sanitation for tomorrow, what they can do today. This is Vicki Boyd reporting for My Ag Life.
Hi friends, Jason Scott here, CEO of JCS Marketing. I want to personally invite you to My Ag Night on November 2nd. Look forward to seeing you there.
Hey, it's Jesse Waters from Fox News Channel. Hope to see you at My Ag Night on November 2nd. It's going to be a night you will not want to miss.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture has announced $23 million in awards to support dairy businesses and producers under the Dairy Business Innovation Initiatives Program. Jenny Lester Moffitt, USDA Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs, made the announcement at the World Dairy Expo.
There are four centers around the country, so that money will be split amongst those four centers. But here in the Midwest, $7 million will be invested of that $23 million in the Dairy Business Innovation Initiative. Combined for the Midwest, what that $7 million will total be about $40 million since 2019 that we've invested here in Midwest production for dairy innovation.
Moffitt says innovation means a variety of different things.
They're doing things like developing new innovative cheese products, packaging lines so that they can sell into new market opportunities. They're investing in, of course, things like turning byproduct from dairy production, like whey, into new value opportunities, like vodka, for example. And the bioeconomy is an important economy that I know many farmers across the country are looking at. Byproducts in dairy production into ethanol, or also turning the byproduct in the actual dairies themselves and things like turning manure into renewable energy through digesters or into important nutrients through fertilizer production as well.
The initiative supports small and mid-sized dairy businesses in the development, production, marketing, and distribution of dairy products. Five of the eight major retail fertilizer prices are more expensive compared to last month. Of the five, three fertilizers had a considerable price increase. Anhydrous was 13% higher compared to last month, with an average price of $767 a ton. Both MAP and UAN32 were 6% more expensive, looking back a month. MAP had an average price of $777 a ton. UAN was at $413 a ton. The two remaining fertilizers had slightly higher prices compared to last month. Urea had an average price of $570 a ton, and 10340 was at $610 a ton. Three fertilizers were lower compared to the prior month, albeit just slightly lower. DAP had an average price of $703 a ton, and potash was at $508 a ton, while UAN22 was at $353 a ton. Two of the Natural Resources Conservation Service's flagship programs are currently accepting applications for project funding for the new fiscal year. USDA Ag News reporter Rod Bain.
Now being accepted at local USDA service centers. Fiscal year 2024 applications for two of the department's natural resources conservation programs, Environmental Quality Incentives Program and Conservation Stewardship Program.
We've made those funds available to our states, so EQIP and CSP. Folks should walk into our USDA office. We're having signups right now.
Natural Resources Conservation Service Chief Terry Cosby says in addition to EQIP and CSP signups focused on climate smart practices, applications for the current funding cycle for the Agricultural Conservation Easements Program are being accepted through November 13th. while sign up for regional conservation partnership program funding opportunities is scheduled to take place early next year. Additional details are available online at www.nrcs.usda.gov. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Households spend more money on food as their incomes rise, but the amount spent represents a smaller share of their overall budgets, according to USDA's Economic Research Service. When U.S. households were divided into five equal groups by household income, households in the lowest income group had an average after-tax income of $16,337 and spent an average of $5,090 on food, or about $98 a week in 2022. Households in the highest income group had an average after-tax income of $196,794 and spent an average of $15,713 on food, about $302 a week. As households gain more disposable income, they often shift to more expensive food options. Food spending as a share of income rose across all income groups in 2022 as food prices increased faster than the overall inflation rate. In 2022, food spending represented 31.2% of the lowest groups' income, 13.4% of income for the middle group, and 8% of income for the highest group.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing team, thank you for listening.